A cloud of cigarette smoke hangs in the air as the Oval Office hums with tension. Outside, in Washington and around the world, markets are twitching. Aware of the stacks of gold bars that fill the vaults of Fort Knox, foreign central banks are increasingly demanding redemption. A memo slides across the Resolute desk. Convertibility tired. Phone call after phone call. Paris wants gold. London wants gold. The Treasury pipeline is redlining. Nixon sinks into his chair with the weight of the financial world bearing down on him. For decades, the U.S. dollar stood as the linchpin of the post-war financial order. Under the Bretton Woods International Monetary System, every major currency was pegged in relation to the dollar, and that dollar pegged to gold at $35 an ounce, redeemable on demand for foreign governments. The arrangement anchored trust. It allowed America to issue dollars abroad, to wage war, to stimulate growth, and still reassure the world that those dollars were backed by something real. But by the early 1970s, the system began to wobble. The Vietnam War was bleeding money. The Great Society programs demanded more than taxes could reliably supply. American factories were losing ground to rising powers in Europe and Japan. Dollars flooded out in trade deficits, military spending, and foreign aid. Foreign holders of dollars, once content to accumulate them, now requested conversion to gold. The U.S. gold reserves shrank. The pressure mounted, and trust wavered. Inflation rose quietly at first. Groceries, rents, insurance. In public housing projects, you saw it faster. Peeling paint, broken pipes, roofs that leaked in winter storms. Tight supply in private housing made every vacancy more precious. Mortgage rates climbed. Houses that used to be within reach suddenly felt distant, aspirational. In that moment, Nixon faced a choice. Defend the gold standard at all costs, accept deep cuts and high rates, or rip off the bandage and remake the system. On August 15, 1971, he went on air and delivered what became known as the Nixon Shock.
I have directed Secretary Connally to suspend temporarily the convertibility of the dollar into gold or other reserve assets, except in amounts and conditions determined to be in the interest of monetary stability and in the best interest of the United States. In full cooperation with the International Monetary Fund and those who trade with us, we will press for the necessary reforms to set up an urgently needed new international monetary system. Stability and equal treatment is in everybody's best interest. I am determined that the American dollar must never again be a hostage in the hands of international speculators. I'm taking one further step to protect the dollar, to improve our balance of payments, and to increase jobs for Americans. As a temporary measure, I am today imposing an additional tax of 10% on goods imported into the United States. This is a better solution for international trade than direct controls on the amount of imports. This import tax is a temporary action. It isn't directed against any other country. It's an action to make certain that American products will not be at a disadvantage because of unfair exchange rates. When the unfair treatment is ended, the import tax will end as well.
The U.S. dollar switched from being backed by gold to a fiat system, backed by the government itself. Although announced as temporary, moving forward, the value of the dollar would come from trust and confidence in the government. Paired with the 90-day wage and price freeze and 10% import surcharge, the Nixon shock jolted the international financial system. Now, money's value would depend more on confidence, policy, central banks, and speculation. The floor was being moved beneath the system. Critics complained that it was a breach of faith, a repudiation of discipline, a move towards monetization unchecked. It was. Others warned it would lead to runaway inflation, currency wars, irresponsible spending. It did. Yet, defenders argued that the old tether had become a trap. Economic agents could not respond to recession or crisis if their hands were tied to gold. The flexible dollar would let government act, to inject, to stabilize, to steer, without draining reserves or provoking runs. Also true. Now, there has been a common anecdote shared to explain the logic behind detethering the dollar from gold. It is referred to as the Capitol Hill Babysitting Co-op, based on a real babysitting cooperative in D.C., founded in the late 1950s, and it is described as a microcosm of macroeconomics. Former members Joan and Richard Sweeney first presented the co-op as an allegory for an economy in a 1977 article, but it was popularized by a professor and Nobel Prize-winning economist Paul Krugman in his book, Peddling Prosperity. Imagine 10 couples in a babysitting co-op. They trade tickets for childcare. Out of fear of not having enough tickets when needed, some began hoarding their tickets. Eventually, no one offers to babysit. The system seizes, the equivalent of a recession. Shaming the hoarders doesn't work. So, an alternative solution is to print more tickets, liquidity, to encourage activity. That's Keynesian economics in a nutshell. When demand collapses, a sensible injection can restart the flow. A fiat dollar lets government play that role. The problem is that flexibility invites temptation. Cheap credit, speculative leverage, and asset inflation are all possible side effects, especially if there are no regulations. As the gold anchor fell away, inequality found new room to widen. The steps to opportunity got much steeper, then turned into an escalator for those already at the top. The house you owned, the home you built, they would become not just shelter, but leverage, and for some, profit. That August night did more than unmoor a mechanism of exchange. It reframed national possibility, a dollar untethered, a housing system unrestrained, a crisis for those on the fringe or left renting and excluded. I'm Demetrius Lynch, and this is Built to Divide.
The number of people who are finding themselves homeless every night is visibly increasing in almost every city in the country, and that is the outcome of a housing problem that is not measured by anybody's statistics, but is measured in reality in the most painful kind of way.
There is a growing disrespect for government and for churches and for schools, the news media, and other institutions. This is not a message of happiness or reassurance, but it is the truth, and it is a warning.
In our last episode, we discussed the Fair Housing Act, the establishment of HUD, Section 235 and 236's rise and fall, Robert Moses and Jane Jacobs' fight over the city's soul, and Nixon's pivot from building units to cutting checks. If you haven't listened to that episode, I encourage you to go back and listen to all the episodes of this series in order. In today's episode, we'll dig deeper on Section 8 and the mortgage interest deduction, housing scarcity, Jimmy Carter's moral housing crusade, and stagflation in the late 70s. Then we'll turn to the 80s, rent control's mixed legacy, Milton Friedman's intellectual counterattack, Reagan, Thatcher, tax breaks, deregulation, and the evolving cultural sentiment that made it all possible. And we'll get into all of that after this break. Episode 5, Shock and Awe. Since the Great Depression, the U.S. has provided federal housing assistance programs. But by the early 1970s, the country had poured billions into housing production. Towers, townhomes, redevelopment zones. Yet headlines still blared about riots, slums, foreclosures, and neighborhoods starved of opportunity. The riots of the late 1960s have produced three presidential commissions, the Kerner, the Kaiser, and the Douglas commissions, and each returned with the same diagnosis. America had built a two-track wealth system, one white and ascending, one black and confined. Bad housing wasn't the only cause, but it was always in the frame. Inside HUD, a quiet shift had already begun. George Romney, Nixon's first HUD secretary, raised the profile of research inside the agency, moving HUD away from purely technical solutions, design and construction, towards social science, asking why programs failed, not just how many units could be built. In 1973, Romney was replaced by James T. Lynn, an attorney with a strong business background. Before arriving at HUD, Lynn had served as general counsel and then undersecretary at the Department of Commerce, the federal department responsible for promoting American industry. His resume signaled his instincts: market efficiency, business discipline, and private sector partnerships. He would later be appointed as director of the Office of Management and Budget, then, after leaving government, go on to lead the Federal City Council, one of Washington's most influential business-led groups, known for working behind the scenes to shape economic development and major policy decisions affecting the Capitol.
I hear from a lot of my friends on the other side of the aisle, so to speak, that, we really do need a much bigger deficit. But it's always funny how that accommodates a business-as-usual growth in those 1,030 programs. That as long as we can rationalize or justify a big deficit, having made that decision, now we can say to all you folks, let me tell you, that gives us a chance with all of these programs to add more money to them, and doesn't that make me a hero with every interest group in America?
Lynn's move from commerce to housing wasn't accidental. It marked a calculated shift in posture before any official policy changes were announced. Once in charge at HUD, he merged the agency's research, policy, and evaluation units into a single operation, Policy Development and Research, or PDNR. For the first time, HUD had a centralized, analytic engine designed not to build more, but to question its own assumptions, measure outcomes, and redefine what federal housing policy should be. That winter, Nixon delivered his pivot, calling for, quote, new policies that would provide aid to genuinely needy families and eliminate waste. He commissioned the National Housing Policy Review, a sweeping autopsy of federal, state, and local housing programs. Lynn was put in charge. The working groups were staffed not only by civil servants, but by select private consultants, industry practitioners, and university economists who reframed decades of housing policy in a new language: unit costs, market forces, burden of payment. The previous reasoning, insufficient supply, not enough units, was pushed aside. In its place came a new focus: the share of earnings low-income families spent on rent. The studies argued that the worst housing problem was no longer substandard buildings, it was cost. Families spending 40, 50, sometimes 60% of their income just to keep a roof over their heads. Filtering, the idea that older units would naturally age or trickle down in affordability, was floated as a quiet promise that the market could solve what policy had failed to fix. Through that lens, vouchers, portable subsidies, rather than public units, made sense. Cheaper upfront, less political risk. A way to let the market work, without building towers that might become the next Pruitt-Igoe. However, that approach failed to address immediate housing needs. especially in the context of an economy in rapid decline. Moreover, contributors to the policy review acknowledged existing issues of race and, quote, financing and market imperfections. Vouchers faced inherent issues of the time that were acknowledged but ignored. Despite that, in 1974, Congress passed the Housing and Community Development Act, amending the 1937 Housing Act to create Section 8. The premise was simple. Families would pay roughly 30% of their income towards rent, and the federal government would pay the rest. Instead of building housing, the government would buy access to the private market. There were early sub-programs, new construction, substantial rehabilitation, existing housing certificates. Later came moderate rehab, then the voucher program. Over time, they merged into what we now call housing choice vouchers, with a parallel project-based voucher stream for fixed units. The promise was efficient: mobility, choice, flexibility. The reality was inherited segregation and new clothing. High-profile housing policy leaders like Howard Hussock, senior fellow in domestic policy studies at the American Enterprise Institute and former vice president for policy research at the conservative Manhattan Institute, began to link crime and inner-city social problems to Section 8 housing.
Both Democrats and Republicans have embraced an alternative called vouchers. Well, that hasn't worked very well either. 40% of those who get rental vouchers tell HUD that they live in neighborhoods of serious distress. And residents of neighborhoods to which voucher recipients are moved complain that drugs and crime come along with those vouchers recipients. The administration's response has been to propose moving more voucher holders to the suburbs. Well, that's wrong too. Working families understand that moving to a better neighbor is something you have to work for, not something that you're given. American neighborhoods can be classified on a kind of spectrum, ranging from poor to rich, with all points in between. Americans believe that we work to gain our place on what I call the housing ladder of opportunity and to advance up its rungs. When the government says that we must accept new residents who haven't made their own climb up the ladder, well, Americans become fearful and resentful.
Researchers found no overall crime wave tied to Section 8, despite the claims. In fact, studies like Moving to Opportunity showed modest gains in safety, mental health, and educational outcomes when families could reach higher opportunity areas. But reaching those areas was the challenge. Landlords in high opportunity suburbs refused vouchers. Zoning kept multifamily housing out of white neighborhoods. Brokerage networks didn't show families the places where the schools were strong. And while vouchers expanded, public housing withered behind demolitions, minimal replacement units, and wait lists growing to decades. Considering basic economics, this reduction in housing supply that the government provided predictably drove up demand and subsequently price. At the same time, the mortgage interest deduction, or MID, quietly solidified as the largest housing subsidy in America. The Housing in the 70s report estimated that tax breaks, which largely benefited middle and upper income households, absorbed about 80% of U.S. housing subsidies. That was about $9.5 billion, $6 billion in mortgage deductions, and another $3.5 billion in property tax deductions. But no one proposed cuts or changes to that segment of subsidies. Homeowners could deduct the interest portion of their mortgage payments, lowering their effective cost of borrowing. In the 1970s, as rates climbed and home prices rose, the MID acted as a cushion for buyers who qualified. It was framed as a middle-class benefit, a tool of upward mobility. Upwardly tilted, politically untouchable, and almost invisible in public debate. We call one side of housing subsidies welfare and the other incentive, but they both draw from the same well. One buys needed shelter, the other buys leverage. One key group in protecting this structure was the National Association of Realtors, or NAR. In the 1970s, NAR became the largest trade association in the United States, growing to over 400,000 members and a political juggernaut. In Washington, it lobbied hard to preserve homeowner tax benefits and fight density mandates. Each legislative win of the decade revealed a strategy: protect property values, expand credit, and shield real estate wealth from regulation. In the early 70s, NAR pushed for cleaner mortgage pipelines, blocking equity participation requirements in 1971, helping pass the Emergency Mortgage Credit Act in 1972, and easing land sale regulations throughout the decade. These steps strengthened the real estate finance system at a moment when federal housing programs were faltering. But NAR's deeper impact emerged through tax policy. Throughout the 70s and 80s, it defended and expanded incentives that disproportionately benefited property owners, repealing depreciation constraints in 1974, lowering capital gains taxes in 1978, securing protections for sellers' financing rules in 1985, and most consequentially, preserving MID during sweeping tax reform in 1986. These victories cemented homeownership, not wages, as the engine of middle-class wealth, widening the gap between those who owned property and those who did not. Later in the 80s, it won reforms to protect landlords from rent control in 1984, defended tax-deferred exchanges in 1987 and 89, and even shaped civil rights legislation through the 1988 Fair Housing Amendments. Across two decades, NAR mastered Washington, redefining housing policy around the interests of owners and investors.
Our association consists primarily of residential brokers. We also represent commercial and industrial people. And these people practice real estate all over the country, they and their sales associates. I guess it would be fair to say that they're a pretty conservative bunch, particularly on fiscal matters. For that reason, over the years, we've taken a leading role in urging Congress and the President, various administrations, to cut back on expenditures. Our concern about the federal budget deficit has been a very real and growing one over the past several years, and it is still there.
This is GV Mike Brenneman, spokesperson for the National Association of Realtors at the Conference of Mayors in 1988, discussing community housing and economic development.
And in addition to a housing crisis, I think it was obvious then that we were witnessing a growing gap in terms of the haves and the have-nots in this country, not just in the housing area, but in the overall economic area. Certainly when we speak of housing crisis, we're not talking just about ownership housing. Please don't feel that we're here to talk just about the sales of houses. Certainly that's always a concern of ours, but we're interested in rental housing too. I guess our president-elect Ira Gribben in our earlier meeting in May summed it up best when he said, you know, you can't be a first-time housing buyer unless you're a renter. And that hits home to all of us. If they're not able to be viable renters, then how on earth can they be viable first-time or second-time or third-time home buyers? So we have a very selfish concern in this particular area. At the same time, we have other concerns involving housing and cities. Some of the anti-growth measures, for instance, that we have seen in the city of Washington and elsewhere, spurred on by the citizens, are of grave concern to us because we think there are rights involved of property owners that are being bruised rather badly. What this brought home to us, however, was the realization that we haven't succeeded nearly as well on the local level in terms of getting to know local elected leaders, working with local elected leaders, helping to mold and create public policy. Not nearly as well as we have succeeded on the federal level, where I think, quite frankly, we've been rather successful over the years in influencing policy. And I think we've come to realize that our failure on the local level is one that simply cannot be allowed to continue.
With the expansion of wealth generated through ownership, some of the richest turned those funds toward aligned economists, think tanks, media, organizations, and lobbyists, to reinforce a cycle that bent Congress to their will once more. ultimately expanding their wealth further through lawmaking. Wealth accumulated where rules were favorable and retreated where no rules protected. During a decade of constrained construction and subsidized ownership, the gap between home rich and home poor widened. One street might have a row of houses sized for tax breaks. Across the alley, a low-income housing project struggled with broken windows and boarded units. The same government that subsidized owners was withdrawing from the responsibility of housing those without means. Back in the mid-1970s, cities under inflationary pressure responded with rent control ordinances. In San Francisco, Los Angeles, parts of New York, and elsewhere, rent caps felt like a necessary constraint. Protect tenants from runaway speculative rents, preserve mixed neighborhoods, allow families to stay close to jobs. But there were unintended consequences. Landlords, bound by rigid rental ceilings, deferred maintenance. Some pulled units off the rental market entirely. New multifamily housing development slowed in rent-controlled zones. Systems strained. In some cities, rent control was blamed for shrinking rental stock over decades. Units once protected became neglected. Still, rent control served an essential function. It held at least a few doors open in otherwise tightening markets. It preserved continuity. But alone, it could not offset the structural retreat of public housing or the tax subsidies favoring ownership. As policy retreated, activists responded. In 1974, the National Low Income Housing Coalition formed as a national voice demanding recognition of housing as infrastructure. Not charity, not speculation.
We have three simple goals. We want to preserve existing federally assisted homes and housing resources. We want to expand the supply of low-income housing, and we want to establish housing stability as the primary purpose of low-income housing policy. And we work to achieve these goals through three basic objectives. The first is to change public opinion. We want to intervene so that we can improve the public's understanding of low-income housing needs and solutions, how current federal policy impacts this, and what these needs do to their communities. Our second objective is to increase the capacity of low-income housing advocates. We want to intervene with our members to help them be more successful in educating their policymakers about the issues that we're concerned about and holding them accountable for making good decisions. And our last objective is to basically cause federal policymakers to take action that solves the shortage of housing for the lowest-income Americans.
That was Sheila Crowley, a past president and CEO of the National Low Income Housing Coalition. The organization was founded by Cushing Dolbert, a housing policy analyst, consultant, and one of the leading experts on federal housing policy and low-income housing in the United States. In 2002, as a contributor to the Millennial Housing Commission, Dolbert shared her thoughts on affordable housing and programs available to increase home ownership.
The fact remains that while the number of people with critical housing problems may be overstated, the number of people who are finding themselves homeless every night is visibly increasing in almost every city in the country, and that is the outcome of a housing problem that is not measured by anybody's statistics, but is measured in reality in the most painful kind of way.
Since its founding, the National Low Income Housing Coalition has pressed Congress, shaped budgets, and recorded and elevated stories from neglected blocks. In 1976, Habitat for Humanity found its roots in rural Georgia on a community farm founded by a farmer and biblical scholar, Clarence Jordan. It evolved into the organization founded by Millard and Linda Fuller, who developed the concept of partnership housing. But it gained prominence behind the involvement and leadership of Jimmy Carter.
Mr. President, are you doing something out of office that in the end it was impossible to achieve in office?
No, I think the housing programs that we had when I was in office were very good and very much needed. We have plenty of need in our country and around the world, as a matter of fact, for both government and private entrepreneurs and also volunteers like this. So all three need to work together. Habitat for Humanity is a worldwide organization. We're now in 14 nations in all, with about 50 other projects in this country. So we're building about one house per day for people who don't have homes. We require each family who move into one of our homes to work 500 hours themselves on their house and the neighbor's house, and also be able to make the monthly payments without interest. The Bible says you shan't charge interest to people who are poor. So we believe in biblical economics. So by the time a family gets into a home, they've not only learned a fairly good carpentry trade and have a nice house and some happy neighbors, but they're also making monthly payments that we can use then to build new houses all over the world.
The organization set out to build decent, affordable housing and improve homes for families of low income or disadvantaged backgrounds using volunteer labor and zero interest loans. In its early years, it was piecemeal, often symbolic, but rooted in conviction. Housing is human dignity. Today, Habit has grown to work in all 50 states in the U.S. and in more than 70 countries. When Carter became president in 1977, he sought to bring that giving nature to the White House, marrying policy and purpose.
And I join in the hope that when my time as your president has ended, people might say this about our nation: that we had remembered the words of Micah and renewed our search for humility, mercy, and justice. That we had torn down the barriers that separated those of different race and region and religion. And where there had been mistrust, built unity with a respect for diversity. That we had found productive work for those able to perform it. That we had strengthened the American family, which is the basis of our society. That we had ensured respect for the law and equal treatment under the law for the weak and the powerful, for the rich and the poor. And that we had enabled our people to be proud of their own government once again.
When it came to housing, Carter expanded HUD's enforcement of fair housing, increased funding for Section 8, and made housing equity part of his moral brand. His administration saw housing not as a product, but as a right. However, his presidency struggled, unable to solve the inherited stagflation and energy crisis fast enough. The political pushback and reality of challenges in the country derailed the hopes he once had when he first took office. As he wound down his term, he delivered a warning to the nation in what would be known as the Crisis of Confidence speech.
In a nation that was proud of hard work, strong families, close-knit communities, and our faith in God, too many of us now tend to worship self-indulgence and consumption. Human identity is no longer defined by what one does, but by what one owns. But we've discovered that owning things and consuming things does not satisfy our longing for meaning. We've learned that piling up material goods cannot fill the emptiness of lives which have no confidence or purpose. The symptoms of this crisis of the American spirit are all around us. For the first time in the history of our country, a majority of our people believe that the next 5 years will be worse than the past 5 years. Two-thirds of our people do not even vote. The productivity of American workers is actually dropping. And the willingness of Americans to save for the future has fallen below that of all other people in the Western world. As you know, there is a growing disrespect for government and for churches and for schools, the news media, and other institutions. This is not a message of happiness or reassurance, but it is the truth, and it is a warning.
The American dream, fused with consumer desire and fueled by credit, was spinning towards a new mythology. It promised that in America, if you worked hard enough, you could rise. And if you didn't rise, the fault was yours alone. Pull yourself up by your bootstraps. When that phrase first appeared in an 1800s physics textbook, the question was meant as a joke. Why can't a man lift himself by pulling on his bootstraps? The answer was obvious. It's impossible. But somewhere along the way, the sarcasm became scripture. By the mid-20th century, it had morphed into a moral directive. Advancement is individual, effort is everything, and success is proof of character. This message resonated, especially with rural America, where independence and land ownership were core to identity. I recently came across a social media post that summed it up well. The rural experience is lateral, independent, property-focused, versus the urban vertical experience, public systems, proximity to power. If you rely on yourself and your own property, the logic follows that you want a government that taxes less and does less. But the twist likely came when this ethos was amplified by a growing conservative media machine that served corporate interests. What began as a rural value became a national mantra. The message filtered into boardrooms and Wall Street. Today, we see it in the self-help industry. Rise and grind. No days off. Hustle hard. An entire culture insisting that poverty is a personal failing, not a structural one. Simultaneously, there was a disconnect in perception of the economy. With Black Americans serving as a bellwether for the nation's broader economic health, ongoing Gallup polling on race relations reveals a stark disconnect between white perceptions of opportunity and Black Americans' lived realities. You can see a 30-plus point difference in perception and experience. White participants consistently reported far rosier views on racial equality, economic fairness, and access to education, even as Black families reported significantly negative reviews. In addition to other issues like food insecurity, medical hardship, and structural barriers, many white Americans simply did not believe that systemic obstacles existed. And because the Black community was often the public face of social programs, calls for government intervention became easier to dismiss as waste, dependency, or special pleading. By the mid-1970s, economic turbulence cracked the intellectual foundation of the New Deal and Great Society era. As inflation surged and Keynesian tools faltered, a new chorus of critics rose up. Among them was Milton Friedman, the Nobel Prize-winning economist who argued that markets were wiser than governments, and that planners inevitably distort what they try to fix.
Literally thousands of people cooperated to make this pencil. People who don't speak the same language, who practice different religions, who might hate one another if they ever met. When you go down to the store and buy this pencil, you are, in effect, trading a few minutes of your time for a few seconds of the time of all those thousands of people. What brought them together and induced them to cooperate to make this pencil? There was no commissar sending out orders from some central office. It was the magic of the price system the impersonal operation of prices that brought them together and got them to cooperate to make this pencil so that you could have it for a trifling sum. That is why the operation of the free market is so essential, not only to promote productive efficiency, but even more, to foster harmony and peace among the peoples of the world.
Friedman dismissed Keynesian as naive, championing monetarism, deregulation, and freer markets. His academic work, especially A Theory of the Consumption Function, earned him deep respect among economists, while his book, Capitalism and Freedom, made him a public intellectual. After retiring in 1977, he partnered with the Free to Choose Network, a libertarian nonprofit corporation that produced television programs and videos, bringing his ideas to television and translating theory into persuasion. By 1980, he was advising Ronald Reagan's presidential campaign and later served on Reagan's Economic Policy Advisory Board. His influence crossed the Atlantic as well, shaping Margaret Thatcher's economic revolution when she became prime minister.
There is no doubt that the prime minister has in many ways achieved substantial success for the economy. Yeah. There is one statistic that I understand is not, however, challengeable. And that is that over her 11 years, the gap between the richest 10% and the poorest 10% in this country has widened substantially. How can she say at the end of her chapter of British politics that she can justify many people in a constituency such as mine being relatively much poorer off, much less well-housed, and much less well-provided than it was in 1979. Surely she accepts that is not a record that she or any Prime Minister can be proud of.
Mr. Speaker, all levels of income are better off than they were in 1979. But what the Honourable Member is saying is that he would rather the poor were poorer, provided the rich were less rich. That way you will never create the wealth for better social services as we have. And what a policy! Yes, he would rather have the poor poorer, provided the rich were less rich. That is a liberal policy. Yes, it came out. He didn't intend it to.
The second voice you heard was Margaret Thatcher, Prime Minister of the United Kingdom from 1979 to 1990. Her conservatism centered on individual liberty, shrinking the state, breaking the power of trade unions, and privatizing public assets. Early in her tenure, recession and soaring unemployment eroded her support, until the 1982 Falklands War with Argentina and an economic rebound delivered a sweeping re-election victory in 1983. One of her most consequential policies, Right to Buy, allowed public housing tenants to purchase their homes at steep discounts. It broadened ownership for some while hollowing out the public housing stock for everyone who came after. Inside this shifting political climate, conservative institutions also gained strength. The Heritage Foundation, founded in 1973 by Paul Weyrich, a religious conservative political activist, Edwin Fulner, a former congressional aide and foreign consultant, and Joseph Coors of the Coors Brewing Company, rose to prominence as a muscular ideological factory, shaping policies that aligned with market-first governance.
Hello, I'm Ed Fulner, president of the Heritage Foundation, a Washington-based public policy research organization that is a think tank. Think tanks are basically idea factories. And we're in the idea business because we believe that ideas have consequences. Or, as John Maynard Keynes, the economist, said, it is ideas, not vested interests, which are dangerous for good or evil. Ideas, basically, are the raw materials of laws, which means that people here in Washington involved in the public policy process, like the Congress, officials in the executive branch, leaders in the national news media, have to depend on ideas as the raw material for everything they do. And it's those new ideas that think tanks in Washington are involved in presenting to the public policymakers. Our ideas here at Heritage are usually described as conservative. That is, we believe in promoting traditional American values, we believe in a strong national defense, and we believe in the free enterprise system and free trade. We believe that basically less government is better than more government.
Out of the growing business activist movement of the 1970s, fueled by corporate frustration with Richard Nixon's flirtation with liberal consensus, particularly on climate, and a belief that existing think tanks were too timid, Paul Weyrich and Edwin Fulner set out to build something different, not a research institute, but a political weapon. With seed money from Joseph Kors and ongoing support from the Adolph Kors Foundation, the Heritage Foundation was born. Its board included senior figures from Chase Manhattan Bank, Dow Chemical, General Motors, ExxonMobil, Pfizer, Sears, corporate America's top brass. Heritage advanced a fusion conservatism, pro-business economics paired with the cultural priorities of the Christian right. Over the decades, its influence only grew. Today, the foundation helps shape conservative narratives on transgender rights, critical race theory, Black Lives Matter, climate denial, Ukraine funding, and voter fraud. And since 2023, it has led the creation of, and now execution of, Project 2025, an effort to fundamentally restructure the executive branch. But Heritage's breakthrough moment came in 1981, as Ronald Reagan entered the White House. The foundation delivered Mandate for Leadership, a sprawling 20-volume 3,000-page blueprint containing more than 2,000 recommendations to pull the federal government sharply to the right. Some suggest further right than the Republican Party at the time. It called for dismantling affirmative action initiatives, slashing social spending while raising the defense budget, creating enterprise zones in inner cities, cutting personal income taxes across the board, granting the president line-item veto power, and accelerating development of new strategic bombers. Reagan embraced it. By the end of his first year, roughly 60% of Heritage's proposals had been enacted or placed into motion. With Reagan as its first prominent vehicle, Heritage helped steer the nation into a new ideological era: market first, state shrinking, and increasingly willing to let inequality harden into policy.
The economic ills we suffer have come upon us over several decades. They will not go away in days, weeks, or months, but they will go away. They will go away because we, as Americans, have the capacity now, as we've had in the past, to do whatever needs to be done to preserve this last and greatest bastion of freedom. In this present crisis, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
Ronald Reagan's election marked a defining moment. Declaring that government is the problem, he delivered the final blow to the Progressive and New Deal traditions, eras that, despite their racial exclusions, had actually expanded the middle class and produced the most broadly shared prosperity in U.S. history. Under Reagan, that framework unraveled. Social spending contracted. HUD's budget was cut by more than half. Public housing construction dissolved. Vouchers remained capped. The federal role in housing shifted from builder to bystander, and the shadow of disinvestment lengthened across low-income communities. Reagan's economic philosophy, soon branded as Reaganomics, centered on deregulation and deep cuts to both taxes and public welfare programs. Now, to understand the tax implications, it helps to recall how the U.S. tax system works. Since the federal income tax began in 1913, Americans have paid marginal rates. Income is taxed in tiers, with higher portions taxed at higher rates. So the actual tax percentage overall, or average, is not as high as the marginal tax would lead you to believe. To address failures of companies not paying a living wage, the top marginal rate historically served as a guardrail against extreme inequality, reaching 91 to 92% for the highest portion or bracket of income through the 1950s and early 60s, the very period when income inequality in the U.S. was the lowest on record and many perceived as a prosperous time in the U.S. By the late 1970s, the top rate had fallen to the 70% range. Then came Reagan's first tax cut in 1981, which slashed the top marginal rate to 50%. By the end of his second term, it dropped again to an astonishing 28%. While headlines celebrated tax cuts, deregulation, and a booming stock market, many working families experienced the opposite: stagnating wages, rising living costs, and shrinking social safety nets. The 1980s created a new economic landscape, one where the market was celebrated, labor was weakened, and the working class carried risk once shared across society. Only about 30% of households participated in the stock market at the time. The gains of the decade were real, but they were uneven, and the working class absorbed most of the cost. The promise was trickle-down growth, that the wealthy would reinvest their savings into jobs, innovation, and higher wages. Instead, the savings often flowed into something else entirely: political influence. Tax cuts didn't just enrich the top, they rebalanced power. And remember, the Nixon shock untethered the dollar, inviting temptation, cheap credit, speculative leverage, and asset inflation. Reagan's deregulation was the green light for those with power and assets to fully indulge, and inequality found new room to widen. For some Americans, the 1980s shimmered with material aspiration, designer fashion, luxury cars, booming stock markets, and a cultural embrace of individualism. But the prosperity was uneven. Census data shows that the era of shared growth ended in the late 1970s. Under Reagan, income inequality surged. From 1981 to 1990, the bottom 20% of earners lost 0.1% annually, while the top 20% gained 2.1% per year. The top 5% saw even larger increases, about 3.2% annually. Meanwhile, weakened unions, suppressed wages, and cuts to public programs intensified hardship for low-income families. The social fallout was visible. Homelessness climbed sharply. Reports of child abuse overwhelmed agencies. By the early 1990s, violent crime reached its highest recorded levels. In turn, many high earners, buoyed by stock gains and lower taxes, insulated themselves physically and socially, retreating into new enclaves that mirrored the decade's mantra: wealth is virtue, and inequality as personal failure. Guided by this new ethos, housing evolved. See, in the early 20th century, American homes were smaller, about 900 to 1200 square feet, sturdier, and in some cases multi-generational, built to last. But nothing captures the evolving worldview more clearly than the front porch. Once, the porch was the soft edge between private life and public life, an in-between refuge from heat. Neighbors wandered over, and stories drifted into the street. It was architecture designed for connection. In the late 19th and early 20th centuries, porches flourished. Industrialization made millwork cheap. Catalogs offered ornate columns and railings, and families layered these details onto modest homes. Porches served as shaded rooms before air conditioning, cooled bodies on summer nights, and even doubled as outdoor sleeping space during heat waves. They protected entry doors, welcomed guests, and functioned as the original living room, open, social, communal. But the mid to late 20th century rewired American life. Cars made it easier to leave home for entertainment, telephones replaced doorstep conversations. After World War II, technology and the housing boom that introduced suburban life slowly disconnected us, turning life toward the backyard and indoors in front of TVs. Air conditioning finished the job. The porch, once a stage for community, became unnecessary, then unfashionable, then barely existent, just a cover for rain while you fumble for your door key. What disappeared wasn't just a design feature. It was a social element. Modern homes turned inward. Neighborhoods followed. In losing the porch, we lost one of the few architectural invitations to slow down, sit outside, and see one another. What emerged from the 1980s was a new kind of suburb, sprawling, inward-facing, and dominated by oversized, consumption-centered houses that came to be known as McMansions. These homes, often 2,000 to 3,000 square feet or more, embodied the era's growing wealth divide. They weren't built to strengthen community. They were built to display status. Everything you needed was inside, and everything outside, neighbors, public space, shared life, mattered a little bit less. Gated entrances reinforced the divide, turning neighborhoods into enclaves and marking a physical boundary between affluence and everyone else. Architecturally, McMansions borrowed heavily from historical styles rooted in hierarchy. French chateaus, Mediterranean villas, Georgian estates, yet stripped them of coherence. As postmodern debates consumed the architectural profession, developers filled the void with mass-produced imitations of grandeur. The results were often cheaply built. Mismatched windows, oversized columns, synthetic ornament, and sprawling forms capped by complicated, leak-prone roofs. Inside, double-height rooms, echoing voids, and awkward layouts created vast inefficiencies in energy, materials, and space. These houses weren't simply large. They symbolized a cultural turn, away from modest, community-oriented post-war homes, away from durable craftsmanship, towards spectacle, consumption, and separation. In the landscape of rising inequality, the McMansion became the built expression of excess. As federal housing policy shifted towards vouchers, deregulation, and shrinking public investment, the private market moved in the opposite direction, towards scale, control, and privatized visions of community. Few symbols captured the turn more clearly than the Irvine Company under Donald Brin. Brin, the son of Hollywood-adjacent parents, movie producer Milton Brin, and civic leader Marion Newbert, had style, discipline, and ambition. He studied business and economics at the University of Washington, served as a Marine Corps officer, and briefly chased his Olympic dreams in skiing. In 1958, he borrowed $10,000, roughly $111,000 today, to build his first house in Newport Beach and flipped it for a profit. That spark became the Brin Company, which grew from suburban homes to commercial development, and eventually to co-founding the Mission Viejo Company, where Brin helped shape one of Orange County's early master plan cities. By the mid-1970s, Brin had built a reputation as a builder with sophistication, exactly the image Taubman Company marketing executive Robert Schaut believed would appeal to power players Adolph Alfred Taubman, or Al, and Herbert Allen Sr. of Allen & Co., for a new deal they were eyeing. After the Tax Reform Act of 1969, which ensured high-income earners pay some taxes despite deductions and exemptions, the historic Irvine Company, founded in 1864 by James Irvine, Benjamin and Thomas Flint, and Llewellyn Bixby, was forced to end its cattle business and sell. Shout made the call.
I found our guy.
Who?
Donald Bren.
Why?
Because, Al, you and I look like a couple of gangsters from Detroit. This guy looks like he came from Hollywood.
Taubman told Shout to offer Bren 35% of the deal. Shout pulled Bren aside and reportedly said, quote, "Shake my hand. I'm going to make you one of the richest people on the planet," end quote. He was true to his word. The Irvine Company held 185 square miles of land. Prior to the deal with Bren's group, 1,500 acres was sold to the soon-to-be University of Irvine in 1961, leaving about 118,000 acres to be acquired. By 1983, Bren became chairman. In 1996, he bought out every partner and became sole owner. With that control, Bren shaped Orange County in his own image.
The company has been a private company for all these years. There was one point that we took a segment or a group of the company, the apartment group, public for 5 years. That was an interesting opportunity, but I am convinced that community development, large-scale community development, has to be done in a private environment, meaning that there are no quarterly dividends required. The cash is reinvested into the planning, into the infrastructure, into the asset portfolio of office, retail, industrial, and apartment properties.
The Irvine Company, now holding more than 120 million square feet of real estate, including hotels, marinas, office buildings, apartment complexes, major shopping centers, and a 97% stake in New York's MetLife building, one of the most valuable buildings in New York City, crafted some of the most meticulously planned, tightly governed, and highly amenitized communities in America. Gated entries, private roads, manicured parks, architectural guidelines, and powerful homeowner associations created a curated suburban ideal. As the Los Angeles Times put it, quote, "Orange County looks like Orange County because of the influence of Donald Bren," end quote. Master planning promised safety, beauty, and order, but it was also fundamentally homogeneous and exclusionary. In an era when public housing construction collapsed and rents rose, the Irvine Company's growth represented a different kind of map-making. Luxury on one side of the gate, shrinking opportunity on the other. By the mid-1980s, the consequences had become systemic. Neighborhoods once protected by red lines, by local covenants, by zoning, hardened further. Apartment complexes aged, maintenance deferred, rents climbed, public housing stock shrank, vouchers stretched thin, and as the middle class held on to homes, they watched the gap to the majority who rented widen. We entered a world where owning meant more than shelter. It meant tax shelter, political voice, accumulation. Decades of exclusion built up a longing, a ravenous desire for a chance at ownership. That would lay the rails for what came next. Subprime mortgages, predatory lending, securitization, and in the end, collapse. A crisis that would bankrupt families, destabilize banks, hollow out cities, and further enrich asset owners. the next chapter would be written in foreclosures, toxic bundles, wealth losses, and institutional acquisitions. We'll track how Clinton and Bush thought they could democratize ownership, how institutions like Blackstone turned foreclosures into portfolios, and how gentrification, new urbanism, and zoning wars shape the new maps of inclusion and exclusion. The Babysitter's Club of American Finance printed more tickets. Then someone realized you could bundle the tickets, sell them, bet on them, and build a fortune on the belief that the night out never ends. Next time on Built to Divide.
Today, all across the country, I say to millions of young working couples who are just starting out, by the time your children are ready to start the first grade, we want you to be able to own your own home.
Thanks for listening. Built to Divide is presented by Lines, my architecture and creative studio. This podcast is produced in collaboration with Gable Media. If you enjoyed the show, please tell a friend and rate and review it on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. It really helps others find it. And if you're looking for similar content, Built to Divide is part of the Gable Media Network, where you can find even more like this. Visit GableMedia.com. That's GABLmedia.com. And before I go, if you want to see additional photos, video clips, and content that went into this episode, you can visit me at lines.studio/podcasts. Talk soon.
Speaking of making things, I understand that you've turned one part of this floor into a furniture shop. Is that right?
That's true. It used to be a kitchen years and years ago. Then it was a broadcast room under Franklin Roosevelt. President Truman used it to show movies. Now we have an upholstery shop here where we do all our furniture restoring and upholstering.
Do you do all of the reupholstering of these old pieces in here?
We do, mostly. It's much quicker and more practical. So exciting to see things grow every day. And then also in this room, we have three ladies on loan to us from the National Park Service who catalog every single item in the White House, so we'll be sure nothing is lost track of again. All donors will be given credit in the booklet that everyone can see.